So I'm really excited about tonight's lesson. I'm excited about every time we get together to study from the scriptures. Tonight in our religious studies class, we'll be talking about Islam. This is by request. So I'm grateful for the request to talk about this. And let me just also mention, if there are things that you would like to talk about, if there are particular religious beliefs or doctrines that you would like to spend some time in class discussing, I would love to hear it. That's kind of what this class is all about. We've got plenty to talk about, and we'll by no means cover everything, but if there's something that is of particular interest to you, by all means, please let me know so that we can work up a lesson on it like we did with Islam tonight. Someone who is a practitioner of Islam is called a Muslim or an Islamist, although Muslim is the much more common term. And where to begin, right? How about I share this bit of news that I heard just on the radio today, by the way, stating that Islam is the biggest religion in the world. Now, that's what the claim was. That's technically not true. In the world, there are about 1.6 billion, billion with a B, billion Muslims, 1.6 billion. Those who call themselves Christians still outnumber that. There are a little over 2 billion, billion with a B, Christians, quote-unquote Christians. I say that because we know not everyone who calls himself a Christian really is a true New Testament Christian. For a bit of contrast there, there are 2 million, million with an M, 2 million members of Churches of Christ in the whole world. Just a hair over 2 million with an M, 2 million members of Churches of Christ in the world. About 1.3, 1.4 million of those worldwide members of Churches of Christ are in the U.S. So, you know, 1.3, 1.4 million members of the Churches of Christ in the U.S., the whole rest of the world together, rounds that number out and gives us the roughly 750,000 remaining Christians, members of the Church of Christ in the world. So, 2 million members of the Church of Christ worldwide, 2 billion people who call themselves Christians worldwide, 1.6 billion Muslims. So, no, technically, Muslims are not the biggest religious group, but they are definitely, I mean, not even close, definitely the fastest growing group. And again, it's not even close. I mean, they're growing very, very, very rapidly. Most of this growth is happening in Europe, where in the next couple or three decades, it is projected. I should have made a slide with this. I beg your pardon. I apologize for not doing that. If you want me to repeat any of that to jot it down, I'll be happy to do that, or you could just Google it. That's what I did. But I'll be happy to repeat if there's something you didn't catch. The Muslims are growing fastest in Europe, where in the next two or three decades, it's projected that 70% of the European population will be Muslims, and of course, by that time, there will be as many Muslims as there are Christians in the world, and from there, Muslims are expected to outpace and outnumber people who call themselves Christians. So, you know, this is not a fringe thing. It's not some fly-by-night group that we're talking about. That woke me up. Not that we really need waking up, but that kind of wakes us up to, you know, the scale of what we're talking about. Not so sure how readable this is. I did my best. I even made this on the computer upstairs so that there wouldn't be any mix-ups in translation. But I suppose after going over some of those stats, we could mention some of the major parts of the Muslim religion. These are their five pillars, and the first is a statement of faith, and their statement is, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. They pray five times a day. I'm sure you're familiar with all this. This is basic stuff, but it gives us a nice on-ramp to maybe a deeper discussion this evening. They pray five times a day, at dawn, at noon, mid-afternoon, at sunset, and at night. And they do this facing Mecca, you know. As a people, they're very generous. Giving is a pillar of their faith. We noticed a whole lot of this next one, number four, when we lived up outside of Dearborn, which is the largest concentration of Muslims anywhere outside of the Middle East. They fast during the month of Ramadan from sun up to sundown, right? So they don't eat anything all day, but all bets are off at night. there were some restaurants that I enjoyed going to. There are not many restaurants I don't enjoy going to. And during Ramadan, which is, you know, it fluctuates a little, I suppose, but it's summertime, June, July-ish, you know. And I would notice during that time that there would be specials, Ramadan specials, come in at sunset, obviously, because that's when, you know, starting at sunset's when you're allowed to eat. Come in and, you know, eat and eat and eat and eat. And the football teams, the school football teams would hold their practice in evenings, you know, to accommodate not being able to eat during the day. So that is a pillar of theirs. And then the once-in-lifetime pilgrimage to Mecca, if possible. My dentist up in Michigan when we lived there, he was gone for a while, and then the next time I went to see him, he said, you know, I went on the pilgrimage, went to Mecca. So they take it very seriously, and those are some of the main tenets. I mean, certainly there's more that they live by than this, but these, I mean, they're called pillars for a reason. This is very important to them. I thought we would discuss a bit more about Muhammad. He is the founder of this religion. I think that would be fair to say. Born in 570 in Mecca. He died 632. He was orphaned at a very early age, so he was taken by a family member to raise. Muslims claim that he was illiterate, which is, you know, not something that you would generally want to claim about the founder of your religion, but they have a reason. They have a reason for making this claim, and their reason for claiming vehemently that he was uneducated, couldn't read or write, is to say that the Quran, which came through Muhammad, to the people, through him, it's claimed that since Muhammad himself was illiterate, that this is a miracle, you know. So that gives it instant veracity, in their minds at least. At age 40 is when he claimed to have received this message from God. And interestingly enough, he claimed that this message from God came through an angel. Anybody recall the angel he cites as Gabriel? Yeah, right, the angel Gabriel. So, you know, there we go. At age 40, he receives this revelation, and off to the races. Thought we would talk a bit more about their scriptures called the Quran. It's a book that's made up of 114 chapters. They call these chapters surahs. I'm perhaps not pronouncing this stuff correctly. My apologies. I'm trying my best. But they have 114 chapters in their book. So, you know, each of these chapters have in any number of verses. Some that I looked at in prepping for tonight's class had hundreds of verses. Others, you know, fewer than 10 or 15. So it's just, you know, all over the place. Kind of similar, I suppose, to chapters and verses in our Bible. I mean, there's no uniform length of these messages. And that's the case with their book. I made some slides of some quotations from the Quran, and these are things likely you've heard many times before. This comes from chapter 4, verse 76, "Those who believe fight in the cause of Allah." It's a very, it's a very fighting religion. Of course, I don't have to tell you that. And violent. Chapter 2, verse 191. "Kill them wherever you find them." Chapter 8, verse 12 resonates a lot, doesn't it? "I will cast terror in the hearts of those who disbelieve. Therefore, strike off their heads and strike off every fingertip of them." So, Muhammad received these instructions. He claims to have received these instructions from God, and immediately got right to work fighting for his religion. This is a bit of my commentary, and I would feel free to hear. I would love to hear your thoughts or impressions of this sort of thing. The Islamic religion seems to be, you know, one part religion, one part political movement. And it was kind of like that from day one. Because as soon as Muhammad received these instructions, he didn't go from town to town preaching this message. He went and found some people that he didn't get to fight for him. And the last 10 years of his life, he accrued an army. So a religious leader who was, you know, a military leader, a religious leader who raised an army to fight for and spread this cause. He died, we mentioned earlier in the presentation, he died 632. You know, it was the year 637, so 5 years later, 5 years after Muhammad's death, that Muslims took over the city of Jerusalem, right? By force, obviously. All of this stuff is happening by force, under threat of death. And Muslim control of Jerusalem lasted for about 400-ish years, till about 1025, 1030 AD, when, you know, the whole Crusades were fought. So this, right out of the gate, was a very, very militaristic religion, a very combative religion. Like I mentioned earlier, one part religion, one part political movement. So what have we mentioned so far? Those are a few, you know, hot and heavy facts, basic stuff. But still, what have we mentioned so far that has caught your attention? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Right. So to the best of my understanding, I probably should have led with this admission if it's not perfectly obvious. I'm no expert on the Quran. I can do research, and I have, and I've enjoyed quite a bit of it. To the best of my understanding, this is speaking to devotees of the religion, right? And it's speaking about everybody who's not, you know. So it's a very black and white system, and I don't mention that necessarily as a criticism. I don't mention that necessarily as a criticism. It's a very black and white system. You're either one or you're not one, right? And if you're not one, well then, you know, my understanding of their instructions is that they can do whatever they have to do to make you one. And if you say, no, I don't want to be a Muslim, well then, you know, they have permission to in you. And I didn't include this because I didn't really want to get into the weeds, this being a single class on the topic. I thought there were some more important high points to mention. But you know, the Bible has commentators, the Bible has commentaries, and I've also found that the Quran has commentators, the Quran has commentaries. And the commentaries, some of which I read, they back up this very violent, I guess that's the word I want to call it, this very violent, this very combative interpretation of their scriptures. So it's, I guess that's a bit of a long-winded way of saying, yeah, it means what it says, you know, cast terror in their hearts. I mean, that kind of means what it says, and it kind of means what it kind of sounds like, you know, and that's not just the words from their book, but also backed up by some of their commentators and teachers of the Quran. Yes, sir, Patrick. There are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. You're right. That's sure. No. That's kind of what we've all heard, right? I mean, and yeah, right. If you are a non-Muslim, you know, Jew, Christian, or undecided, if you're not a Muslim, you are an infidel, and it's their job, you know, to make you a Muslim or to get you out of the way, right? Yes, sir. Well, it certainly doesn't sound moderate, does it? Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, you know, I heard somebody say, and I mean, feel free to chime in. I'm not Bill O'Reilly, right? I'm not going that way with this class. But I heard somebody say, no, this is not a radical interpretation of the Quran. This is just like a regular old interpretation of the Quran. Like, you just read this, and yeah, it's not a radical interpretation. It's just like saying he who believes and is baptized is not a radical interpretation of Mark 16:16. It's just, you know, it's just a basic interpretation of it. You know what I'm saying? If I can kind of draw that parallel, which is, you know, not perfect, but. Yeah, some folks are, especially in light of recent events, you know, especially in light of recent events, some folks are saying, hey, this is not, you know, this is not a radical interpretation of their scriptures. It's just reading it, a basic interpretation, right? And you know, my point for kind of going down that rabbit hole was to say it was like that from day one. It was like that from day one. So to my very untrained in Islamic studies eye, it doesn't seem that the Islamic religion has mutated. It kind of seems like it's doing the same thing it was doing in 600-ish A.D. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Yes, sir. Right. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of back and forth fighting, for sure. So, go ahead, Sam. Yes, sir. Right. That's on my list. Yes, sir. That's all right. Right. Indeed. Right. So Sam's comment, that's where I wanted to go next, right, is to look at this in light of the Bible, and look at Islam. You know, so far we've been just kind of talking about it as its own organism, looking at it now in light of what the Bible says, okay? So as Patrick mentioned, the Quran is not silent about other religions. The Quran is not silent about Jesus. Muslims acknowledge Jesus, I guess. But their scriptures, right here you see a quotation of one, chapter 4, verse 157, says that Jesus did not die on the cross. It says that the Jews did not kill Jesus. And if you say that Jesus was crucified, then you're lying. Elsewhere in their scriptures, they deny the fact that Jesus is God's begotten Son. So, I mean, that's, can't have that, you know. Saying that if you say that Jesus was crucified, you've lied. Saying that Jesus is not God's Son, I mean, if you're not, you know, that's, can't have that, sorry. Yes, sir. Chuck. Right. 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 Yes, nice point, Chuck. Yeah, so they straddle the issue, right? In the way that Chuck just identified, they say, "Oh, we accept Jesus. You know, we believe that somebody named Jesus was real, but you know, their scriptures say he wasn't crucified. And if you say he was, you're a liar. And their scriptures say he's not God's Son." Farther back to Sam's point, the Muslims claim the Abrahamic promise. You remember, you know what it is we speak about when we speak about the Abrahamic promise. It's very famously found in Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. "The Lord said to Abram, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, to a land that I will show thee. I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee. I will make thy name great. Thou shalt be a blessing. I will bless them that bless thee, I will curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Now, we understand this as a promise to Abraham, to send whom? Christ, right? Christ. Abraham's son, well, kind of a trick question, I guess. Who was Abraham's son? Ishmael. And the Muslims, I beg your pardon? The Muslims track their link or their claim to the Abrahamic promise through Ishmael. So look at Genesis chapter 16 about Ishmael. And what can you tell me about Ishmael's birth? Right. Okay. So look at Genesis 16:1. Sarah, Abraham's wife, what about her? She had no children, right? She could bear Abraham no children. Right. So you just rewind the tape a little bit, and God promises Abraham a great nation, right? Well, problem. Sarah can't have children. Genesis chapter 16, verse 1. This is the passage in our Bible that we frequently characterize as, you know, Abraham and Sarah trying to help out God, right? You've heard it called that before, haven't you, right? So Abraham and Sarah hatch this plan for Abraham to sire children with Hagar. And, you know, that happens. Backfired for 13 years. Backfired for thousands of years. Yes. Big problems, right? So, Genesis chapter 16, verse 15, Hagar bore Abraham a son who is called Ishmael, right? And so it's the Muslim claim that Ishmael is the son of promise, right? Is Ishmael the son of promise? No. Isaac is the son of promise. It's noteworthy, after Ishmael's born, God still says to Abraham, I'm going to give you a son. So what's that tell you? Well, that tells you Ishmael's not the one, right? Genesis chapter 17, God is still saying, I'm going to give Abraham a son. And this is the part of the equation where Sarah hears this and she laughs. You know, this is impossible. In her mind, not impossible with God. So later, Isaac is born, and it's interesting to note that the promise is repeated to Isaac in Genesis chapter 26, verses 3 through 5. The same promise given to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 is given to Isaac in Genesis chapter 26, and who is Isaac's son? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And this same Abrahamic promise is repeated to Jacob in Genesis 28. So, go ahead. Of laughter. Right, you're right, Sam. So, Genesis chapter 12, the promise is made to Abraham. Genesis chapter 26, the promise is made to Isaac. Genesis chapter 28, the promise is made to Jacob. That is the Holy Spirit saying, here's the path that you need to follow. Right? Not Ishmael. In fact, when we get to Galatians chapter 3, chapters 3 and 4, Galatians makes this point very, very, very clear. Galatians chapter 4 is a detailed explanation of Hagar, the bondwoman, Sarah, the free woman. We better not dig into that too much as time is kind of getting away from us. But it makes very, very clear. Look at Galatians chapter 4, verse 28. Galatians 4, 28. Someone want to read that for us real, real quick? Galatians 4, 28. So who's the son of promise, Ishmael or Isaac? Isaac. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16 again. Isaac is the seed. Paul constructs an argument about the seed. Isaac who leads to Christ. That's the lineage that needs to be followed. So, hundreds of years. This struck me as I was putting some of these pieces together. Hundreds of years before Muhammad was born, the Lord and inspiration is heading this false doctrine off at the pass. You find the Bible doing it. There are a whole lot of reasons why I believe the Bible's from God, but this one's on the list. The Bible's amazing ability to anticipate a false doctrine and correct that before it even shows up. Galatians chapter 4, hundreds of years before Muhammad, and the answer to Muhammad is right there. The Quran as a book is very, very, very underwhelming. And this is not just my assessment. This is uniformly attested to. In terms of historical accuracy, the Quran doesn't score very highly. In terms of consistency, the Quran doesn't score very highly. Not only does the Quran disagree with the Bible, the Quran disagrees with itself. It's not a consistent product. In terms of integrity, it's not a book that scores very, very highly. Portions of it are verifiably plagiarized. In terms of proliferation, the spread of Islam is not credited to the beauty of the Quran. The spread of Christianity is frequently credited to the beautiful nature of the Bible. The spread of Islam is credited to, guess what? The sword. The literal sword. The message that says, you're going to believe this or you're going to die where you stand. That's credited with the spread of Islam. So the proliferation is not credited to their book. This is not, I don't mean this the way that it's going to sound, but this is not a class about the Bible. Generally speaking, every class that we teach, we want to be about the Bible. This is about a religion that doesn't come from the Bible. So obviously it's a little different tonight. But since we're talking a bit, I'll come to your comment in just a second, Sam. Since we're talking a bit about the Quran and drawing some contrast here, you know, some may ask, well, who do you believe wrote the Bible, right? Who do you believe wrote the Quran? If I get asked that question, I'm going to say, I think Muhammad did it, like by himself. If somebody asks me, who do you believe wrote the Bible? I'm going to say, well, I think God did it. When someone asks, who do you believe wrote the Bible, I want to ask them back first, what are my options? And our options are God or man, right? Who wrote the Bible? Either God or man. And if you say that God wrote the Bible, wonderful, you're ahead of me, and let's just start studying the Bible as a message from God. If you say that man wrote the Bible, though, okay, let's talk about that for a second or two. What kind of people do we have in this world? Well, correct me if you think I'm wrong. I think we could break it down into these three groups. Number one, we have crazy people. Number two, we have bad people. Number three, we have good people. Strike number one off the list. Crazy people did not write the Bible, right? Don't care what people say. The Bible is much too logical, much too beautiful, much too consistent to be the product of insanity. Crazy people didn't write the Bible. So bad people wrote the Bible. Okay, bad people wrote the Bible. What does the Bible say about bad people? What does the Bible say is going to happen to bad people? Saved or lost, up or down? Tell me. Lost. So a bunch of bad people got together and wrote a book that condemns them. Does that make a ton of sense? Does that make a ton of sense? I don't think so. So good people wrote the Bible. This is what a lot of people say. A lot of people say good people wrote the Bible. Well, if good people wrote the Bible, and they just made it up because it didn't come from God, were they honest or were they liars? Liars. And what does the Bible say is going to happen to liars? Yeah, so these good people aren't so good if they're not telling the truth. So who wrote the Bible? None of the above. Because people didn't write the Bible, God wrote the Bible. And that makes it very, very, very different from the Quran. The religion of the Bible is very, very, very different from the religion of the Quran. I know we could go on lots more talking about this. Let's end here so that we can give adequate time for our devotional. Let's end here, and if we would like to pick this subject up at a later time next week or so, we certainly can do that. Okay, thank you so much for your attention. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road Congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.